Good morning. This is Andrea with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated July 13. We'll start with a survey article from the Data Center's Land Power Use Feared in Rural America by Lauren Cross, Investigate Midwest. Data center construction is shifting toward rural America. At the same time, rural residents report greater concern than urban and suburban Americans about what those projects could mean for their electricity costs and farmland use. That's according to a survey released June 26 by researchers at the University of Illinois and Purdue University. The survey of about 1,000 U.S. adults conducted in February found rural residents expressed the highest average level of concern overall. Their greatest concern was rising electricity costs, followed by the use of agricultural land for data centers and overuse of water. Many unknowns remain about the full impact associated with data center growth and expansion, according to researchers. By 2030, the energy requirements for data centers are projected to more than double in Illinois and triple in Indiana, Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, researchers added, citing the University of Virginia's Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. According to a separate analyst of mapping data by the Pew Research Center, a major shift is underway. Nearly 90% of all existing data centers are in urban areas, but 67% of planned facilities are slated for rural communities, and 39% are planned in counties without an existing data center. More than 1,500 data centers are in development nationwide, according to PRC. Virginia leads the way with 398 operating and 287 planned. Illinois is the top Midwest state with 139 operating and 123 planned, according to the April analysis. The nonpartisan think tank reported that the Midwest has 419 planned data centers and 655 existing ones, a 64% increase from its current total. The South leads the way with more than 750 planned data centers and 1,209 existing ones. The findings come as more data center proposals target rural communities, where local officials often have fewer resources to evaluate complex development agreements, U of I researchers pointed out. Large companies that operate AI-scale data centers can bring specialized lawyers, engineers, and financial analysts to structure those projects and decide on-site locations. By contrast, many rural communities have limited decision-making capacity due to budget and staffing constraints, and they often rely on volunteer mayors or part-time elected officials. Often, they are simply not equipped to make these informed decisions or to effectively negotiate with companies that own data centers, the researchers said. An article on state politics, headline reads, Illinois House to investigate Ammons. DOJ indicted Urbana Democrat husband on fraud charges by Ben Zielinski, Capital News, Illinois. An Illinois House committee will investigate actions by Representative Carol Ammons, Democrat Urbana, following her indictment on 10 federal charges this week. A group of 11 House Republicans filed a petition on Friday to create a special investigating committee, a sparingly used process laid out in House rules that can be initiated by any three members, regardless of party. The body, which by rule has its members appointed by the legislative leaders, is expected to explore Ammons' conduct and could ultimately lead to her expulsion from the General Assembly. But when it will get to work isn't immediately clear. The process was last used to probe then-House Speaker Michael Madigan in 2020. Now-House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch, Democrat Hillside, chaired that effort, which did not end in discipline, though Madigan was eventually convicted in court. Democratic leadership has said the court should handle this, House Republican leader Tony McCombie, Republican Savannah, said in a statement. The courts should absolutely do their job, but the Illinois House has a responsibility to do ours. Accountability in the legislature cannot be outsourced to the criminal justice system. Ammons, a state representative since 2015, was indicted on multiple felony charges Wednesday, including wire fraud, lying to an FBI agent, and obstructing justice. Her husband, Champaign County Clerk Aaron Ammons, was also charged with obstructing justice. Ammons' daughter, Tatiana Ammons, was not charged in the same scheme despite prosecutors allegedly she was a beneficiary of her mother's illegal actions. Tatiana Ammons is facing federal unemployment fraud charges in a separate case, however. Prosecutors allege that starting in 2017, Ammons and her daughter received financial benefits in excess of $100,000 via a scheme including illegal payments from the Friends of Carol Ammons campaign account and from payments made to Tatiana Ammons from local nonprofits that received state grant funds arranged by the lawmaker. Ammons released a statement on Friday pledging to fight the charges, according to the News Gazette. She is set to be arraigned in court on July 16. I want to be clear. I have done nothing wrong, and I strongly disagree with the allegations outlined in this indictment, Ammons said. I have complete confidence that the facts will demonstrate my innocence, and I intend to vigorously defend myself through the judicial process. Because this matter is now before the courts, I will not litigate the facts through the media. I have great respect for our judicial system, and I am confident the legal process will provide the appropriate forum for the truth to be established. How it works. Due to House rules, the petition that lists the specific charges the House will be tasked with probing will not be made public until the committee is established. Welch named Representative Curtis Tarver, Democrat Chicago, chair of the committee, with Representative Jay Hoffman, Democrat Swansea, and Representative Lillian Jimenez, Democrat Chicago, joining him. All three are attorneys. The Special Investigating Committee is another process to ensure the House responds appropriately and within our purview, while ensuring nothing we do interferes with the ongoing federal case, Welch said in a statement. McCombie selected Representative Ryan Spain, Republican Peoria, to lead the Republican side of the committee. He will be joined by Representative Dan Ugaste, Republican Geneva, and Representative Adam Niemerg, Republican Dietrich. Per rule, the committee will hold hearings and Ammons will have an opportunity to testify under oath. If at the end of the hearings, at least four of the members vote to authorize charges against her, another 12-member bipartisan committee would be created to weigh any disciplinary action. If discipline is recommended, it would go to the full House for a vote. Most punishments would require a supermajority vote of 71 members, while it takes 79 votes to remove Ammons from the House. It's not clear when the initial investigating committee will first meet, however. The House rules don't outline any timeline for starting the process. Ammons has already been removed from the Democratic caucus and lost access to Speaker's office staff members. Fourth time in 15 years. The committee investigating Ammons will be the first since Republicans initiated the 2020 probe of Madigan after he was named as Public Official A and accused in court documents of bribing utility Commonwealth Edison. Welch chaired that committee, which was formed within days of the Republican-filed petition. But the process was prolonged, and the committee held just three meetings in 4 months, and it deadlocked on party lines with Democrats voting against a motion that stated Madigan engaged in conduct unbecoming of a lawmaker. Madigan was later charged with 23 felonies and found guilty on 10 counts. He was sentenced to more than 7 years in prison. Welch said after the committee dissolved that he believed the courts were a better place to handle legal allegations. A special committee was also established in 2020 to investigate former Democratic Representative Luis Arroyo after he was charged in a bribery scheme. Welch signed the petition to create the committee, but Arroyo resigned before it could meet. Arroyo pleaded guilty and was sent to prison. Former Representative Derek Smith, Democrat Chicago, was the last lawmaker to be expelled from the House following a special investigating committee. He was kicked out of the legislature in 2012 after he was charged with bribery, though he was rejected to the House later that year. He was re-elected to the House later that year. He eventually gave up his office when he was convicted in 2014. In local news, police seize rifle and make arrest after reports of a street fight by Tony Reed. Responding to reports of street violence Saturday night in Decatur, patrol officers wound up chasing down a fleeing man and seizing a rifle, per the police report. Officers were alerted by 911 calls around 10:17 p.m. about a fight in progress near the intersection of South 17 and East Decatur Streets, according to Sergeant Philip Ganley with the Decatur Police Department. Officers responded to the area and a subject immediately took flight, clearly running from the police, Ganley said. An officer chased the subject on foot and he was taken into custody without incident. A K-9 team was brought in and did an article search and located an AR-15 style rifle in the backyard of a residence in the 1600 block of East Decatur Street, he added. The weapon was found on the subject's flight path, but he denied any knowledge of the firearm. Police didn't buy the 41-year-old Decatur man's story, and he was jailed on preliminary charges of being a felon in possession of a firearm, aggravated unlawful possession of a weapon, and resisting and obstructing police officers. All preliminary charges are subject to review by the Office of the State's Attorney. Page 8 features a story titled Dying Aid Movement Grows. There are graphic bubbles with copy stating, after almost 30 years, Oregon's law, the first in the U.S., was enacted in 1997. The addition of two populous states means almost a third of Americans will live in one where medical aid in dying is legally available. The second bubble reads, Illinois set to be 13th state to legally allow the option for patients. And the final bubble graphic reads, medical aid in dying laws allow terminally ill patients to end their lives with a lethal prescription. Article was written by Paula Spann, KFF Health News. Jules Netherland traveled from her home in the Bronx to the New York State Capitol in Albany several times in the past few years, hoping to persuade the legislature to pass a medical aid in dying bill that would allow terminally ill patients to end their lives with a lethal prescription. She spoke at rallies with other members of the advocacy organization Compassion and Choices. She visited legislators' offices. In 2024, as the state assembly debated the bill, she helped unfurl a banner in the chamber gallery that read, Stop the Suffering. Netherland, 59, who works for a nonprofit, was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2019. I did a full year of aggressive treatment, she said. Chemotherapy, a mastectomy, radiation treatment every weekday for 5 weeks, 6 months of 2 oral medications. She recovered and felt well until the cancer returned a few years later. Though metastatic breast cancer is incurable, drugs keep her disease at bay for now. She feels fortunate but also fatigued and contends with brain fog, gastrointestinal symptoms, and joint pain. She feared she might die before the bill, first introduced in New York in 2016, could become law. A breakthrough moment. On June 9, 2025, after the Assembly approved the bill, Netherland saw it pass in the state Senate. Governor Kathy Hochul signed an amended version in February. It takes effect August 5th. A similar law is slated to take effect in September in Illinois, which would become the 13th state, plus the District of Columbia, where medical aid in dying is legal. A breakthrough moment, said Kevin Diaz, president of Compassion and Choices, which spearheaded the campaign for such laws. After almost 30 years, Oregon's law, the first in the United States, was enacted in 1997. The addition of two populous states means almost a third of Americans will live in one where medical aid in dying is legally available. It shows that there's broad support for this model, Diaz said. Polls consistently back that claim. A Pew Research Center survey last spring found almost two-thirds of respondents did not consider the practice morally wrong. Support crossed many political and religious lines. A narrow majority of Republicans and 76% of Democrats found physician-assisted death, also sometimes called physician-assisted suicide, permissible. So did most Catholics, Jews, and non-evangelical white Protestants. In New York, a Santa poll found 54% of respondents supported aid in dying, including majorities of men and women of all age groups and of city, suburban, and upstate residents. A plurality of Latinos supported it. Black respondents narrowly opposed it. Passing these laws grew somewhat easier, said Thaddeus Pope, a bioethicist and professor at Mitchell-Hamline School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota, who tracks such policies. You can say we have 10 years in California, 18 years in Washington, and 29 years in Oregon, and nothing bad has happened. It becomes more accepted. A contentious process. Legalizing medical aid in dying, or MAID, M-A-I-D, remains a long, contentious process. Catholic leadership and many disability organizations staunchly oppose it. The American Medical Association says physician-assisted suicide is fundamentally incompatible with the physician's role as a healer and poses serious societal risk, though a number of state medical organizations opted to remain neutral or, as in New York, support passage. The Patients' Rights Action Fund, through a sister organization, has lawsuits pending or on appeal in California, Delaware, and Colorado, arguing aid in dying laws discriminate against people with disabilities by steering them toward physician-assisted suicide instead of treatment. This is a litigation strategy we've developed to ultimately get to the Supreme Court, said Matt Valliere, the group's executive director, who declined to say whether it would sue to block the Illinois and New York laws. Even when aid in dying laws succeed, using them can prove challenging. In every state except Montana, where it became legal through a court decision, so there is no statute governing eligibility, aid in dying is available only to people with incurable illnesses who are expected to die within 6 months. It typically involves oral and written requests to two doctors, with mandated waiting periods between requests. Patients must have the mental capacity to make the decision, and they must ingest the medication without assistance. An amendment Hochul insisted on adds a psychologist or psychiatrist to the process. All but two states require patients to be residents. Oregon and Vermont scrapped their residency requirements to settle lawsuits brought by Compassion and Choices. Courts ruled against a similar suit in New Jersey. Doctors, hospitals, or healthcare systems can legally decline to provide aid in dying, and religiously affiliated institutions often opt out. Those that participate can add their own requirements. The state can say you need A, B, and C, and Columbia Presbyterian can say we also want D, E, and F, Pope said. Debated but seldom used. Despite widespread support for giving patients this kind of autonomy at the end of life, the number of people who actually use the law is tiny in every state, usually 1% or fewer of the deaths recorded annually. Still, after studies showed many patients seeking MAID, M-A-I-D, died before they could complete the process, some restrictions were loosened. California cut its 15-day waiting period to 48 hours. New Mexico allows physician assistants and advanced practice nurses to write prescriptions along with doctors. Most states have now amended their laws two or three times, Pope said. We have liberalized. Telehealth also can facilitate access to participating doctors. Compassion and Choices plans legal challenges to end residency requirements in additional states, Diaz said, and is considering how to make inroads in Florida and other southern states. The person who has to bear the burden of the suffering should have the ability to decide when it's enough, he added. Anne Gurnett Bander, 72, a retired research scientist in Carmel, New York, cared for her husband for 4 years as ALS, the neurological disorder also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, rendered him bedridden and dependent on feeding and breathing tubes. By the time he died, the only thing he could do was nod his head, she recalled. After she was diagnosed with ALS herself last year, she planned to fly to Switzerland, where the nonprofit organization Dignitas provides medical aid in dying, when she learned about the New York bill and began speaking publicly in support of it, her voice faltering as her illness advanced. Gurnett Bander and Netherlands say they're not certain they'll use lethal drugs to end their lives as their symptoms intensify. Patients often complete the necessary steps, secure the prescribed medication, decide they don't need it after all, and die of their diseases. Still, both women insist the choice should be theirs. In other news, there's an article titled Iron Ore Mine Set to Open in Minnesota by Christopher Vondracek, the Minnesota Star Tribune. Minnesota's first new mine in half a century is just weeks away from its expected opening on what may be one of the last great ore deposits on the Iron Range. The site, concealed beneath work vehicles and a forest floor, is aflutter with activity. About 1,500 contractors pass through a security checkpoint each day to meet the deadline. Job applications are being processed, major permits are in hand, and financial backing is secured to launch the Mesabi Metallics Mine and Taconite Facility Complex. At a cost of $2.5 billion, it's one of the biggest economic investments in the state's history. The mine's opening will conclude a 20-year saga that included a bankruptcy, lost leases, and spurned state investments. Iron ore mining is a large part of the region's identity, but took a hit in the past 2 years with idlings and layoffs at facilities owned by Cleveland-Cliffs and U.S. Steel. A new mine, coming as President Donald Trump and legislators promote domestic steel manufacturing and extraction of natural resources, has economic boosters and officials on the range feeling cautiously optimistic. Yet, unease lingers. Casey Venimas still nurses reservations from the first time India conglomerate SR Group tried to open the mine. SR broke ground in 2008 but faced years of delays and required state subsidies. The project went bankrupt in 2016. Venima worked 7 years for SR Steel Minnesota before its bankruptcy, when the company accumulated $1 billion in debt. After emerging from Chapter 11 bankruptcy and changing ownership groups, SR is back in control of the project, now called Mesabi Metallics. "Are we a little cautious? Of course. It's been a long road," said Venima, an Itasca County commissioner whose district encompasses the mine. "But every day it gets better." The 16,000-acre Mesabi Metallics mining complex is set to produce 7 million tons of direct reduction-grade iron ore pellets this year. The appetite for big American industrial projects grew, but they continue to face red tape and public opposition, especially from environmental interest groups. SR resumed spending on the project in 2023, and Mesabi engaged in a campaign to convince people the mining complex would open. "When SR came back to the project, nobody really wanted to trust them," said Nashwauka Mayor Greyer Hayblom, who attended a Golden Shovel event for the mine in 2007. "This time around, the attitude and respect and consideration are completely different." The company paid $30,000 a month to the city of Nashwauk to help pay for the town's services and roads, as well as $15,000 for projects. It hired local contractors as much as it could to build out the mining complex. Slowly but surely, public opinion shifted. In World Cup news, there's an article titled "FIFA, Expansion Talks Coming Later. Infantino Defends Ticket Prices, Hydration Breaks," by Mark Gleason. Any further expansion of the World Cup, increasing the number of teams participating at the finals to 64, will be discussed after this year's edition, FIFA President Gianni Infantino said. The finals in Canada, Mexico, and the United States have seen 48 teams for the first time, a decision that was heavily criticized, but which has not provoked much debate since the tournament kicked off on June 11th. "These are all issues that we will be examining after the World Cup," Infantino, who successfully pushed for the expansion of the finals from 32 teams, told Swiss television outlet Blue Sport. He did not elaborate, saying only, "I think it's important that when you want to organize a World Cup, you do it for the whole world, not just Europe and South America, but effectively the entire world. Every nation should be allowed to dream of participating in the World Cup. You can see that the quality of the teams is extremely high, and it's getting higher and higher all over the world." Infantino hailed the 48-team tournament as a success, saying, "Every team played at a high level. Teams from every continent scored goals and earned at least 1 point. 9 out of 10 African teams reached the knockout stage. At the last World Cup, there were only 5 teams from Africa. That just goes to show how important it is to include all teams, to give them this opportunity to participate," he added. Infantino also admitted that introducing hydration breaks during each half, which many have seen as an attempt to help television partners get more advertising revenue, had proved controversial. "This is a topic that sparks a lot of debate. After all, we don't want to get everything perfect. We like to give everyone something to disagree with." No, joking aside, last year during the Club World Cup in the USA, there were cooling breaks whenever it was very hot. These short breaks occurred in about 60% of the matches, but not in the other 40% because the temperature wasn't as high. There were many complaints, as the feeling was that all teams should face the same conditions, he said. He also defended the high ticket prices at the World Cup, saying, "The stadiums are full. Capacity utilization is at 99.7%, and it will likely reach 99.9% by the end." Experts determined the ticket prices before the tournament. Our experts worked on that and told us, these are the prices you can go with. We see the proof now. Prices that some people claimed were too high are being resold on the secondary market, which is perfectly legal here, for 4 or 5 times the original cost. Infantino said he expected FIFA to generate $16.08 billion to $17.32 billion from the 39-day World Cup. Another article titled "New Moana Disappoints at the Box Office." The new Moana isn't going very far at the box office. Disney's live-action remake of its 2016 animated hit disappointed in the film's opening weekend, earning $43 million at the North American box office, according to studio estimates released Sunday by Rentrak. That's one of the worst openings for any Disney's live-action remakes, just a hair better than the studio's controversy-plagued revamp of Snow White, which flopped in 2025 with a $42 million debut. The opening was also lower than that of the original animated Moana, which grossed $56 million over 3 days in 2016, or $82 million for the 5-day Thanksgiving holiday weekend. And it was far below the $139.7 million 3-day, $225 million 5-day opening for the animated sequel Moana 2, which released at Thanksgiving 2024. The Moana remake carries a significant production budget of $250 million, according to Variety. In the 2010s, remaking animated hits in live action was a go-to way for Disney to produce box office gold. Some of these live-action remakes, including 2019's The Lion King, are still among the biggest blockbusters of all time. But the failure of Moana, one of Disney's most beloved modern animated movies, raises questions about whether the reliability of the formula has come to an end. Then again, Moana underperforming may have more to do with the issue of timing. Disney has scored biggest at the box office with live-action remakes of films released around 25 years prior, enough time for children who saw the original in theaters to have grown up and had kids of their own. Meanwhile, the lowest-grossing remakes prior to Moana were typically of movies that were much older. The major exceptions are Alice in Wonderland and The Jungle Book, though both of these films were sold on their dazzling 3D visuals more than nostalgia. Alice in Wonderland, in particular, was one of the first big 3D movies released on the heels of Avatar, revitalizing the format in 2009 and rode that wave of hype. Previous live-action remakes were also usually the first theatrical films to feature those central characters in many years, allowing anticipation to grow for the return of Ariel, Simba, or Belle. This wasn't the case with Moana. The franchise had been absent from theaters less than 2 years before its return. It also couldn't have helped that Moana was largely panned by critics who complained that it is a carbon copy of the original movie. But the 2019 remake of The Lion King also received mixed to negative reviews for the same reason and still made $1.6 billion, so that may not be the primary factor that held Moana back. Okay, we'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the Herald and Review for Monday, July 13. Please stay tuned.